the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Our guest today, David, Dr. Marek Dabrowski, is a fascinating central banker, and he was living in a fascinating time and a fascinating place of change in Poland when they shifted from communism over to more of a capitalist system.
As first deputy minister of finance in Poland, he worked with the team that basically transitioned the economy from a command system,
the Cold War,
under communism, to a free market system, tackling major issues at the time, which included massive inflation. And so getting their arms around that in a very short period of time, implementing policies and doing it very quickly, the need to implement it very quickly was absolutely paramount. You know, I encountered Dr. Dabrowski in an article in his Project Syndicate, and we'll include the link to Project Syndicate, his article, next to the interview today. But he's today a professor of economics. He co-founded and is the chairman of CASE, which stands for the Center for Social and Economic Research. He is a fellow there and has been involved in so much in terms of policy research and policy advising. Azerbaijan, Belarus, Bosnia, Bulgaria,
even
Egypt.
Moscow.
Yep, even Moscow, Serbia, Syria, Turkmenistan. I mean, so when you look at sort of transitional economies, when you look at emerging market economies and the challenges that you face, not having all of the advantages that you would have in a fully industrialized country or an advanced economy like the U.S. or other European countries, he's looking and saying, well, what do we have to work with?
Mm-hmm.
If you can imagine an economist being like a MacGyver,
right,
all we have is a little bit of chewing gum and baling wire, perhaps a little duct tape and a Swiss Army knife. How are we going to make this work?
Well, and from reading him, what he's basically saying is, look, guys, if you're counting on the kind of growth aspects or inputs that we've had over the last 20 or 30 years, they're not there anymore. They're shrinking. So we better find something else. And he does have, just from reading his articles, a serious concern of the sustainability of our fiscal situation. Everyone's known over the last 5 or 6, 7 years that we are papering over the problem, but it's not necessarily creating real sustainable growth.
When I encountered Dr. Dabrowski, it reminded me of our conversation going back to 2010 with Harold James. We talked about the end of globalization. We talked about the things that accompany those periods of globalization. We explored the parallels between the 1920s and 30s, sort of a historical analogy between 29 and 31 in the present context. And, you know, again, there was sort of echoes of that conversation as I was looking through the concerns that Dr. Dabrowski has today, where, in essence, we are not addressing structural issues. And again, this is very similar to our conversation with William White. This is very similar to our conversation with many of those in the central banking community today who would say, you know, I understand crisis management and I understand policies, whether it's monetary policies or fiscal policies, which on a short-term basis are necessary as sort of triage. But let's not assume that that represents a long-term fix. Let's not assume that those emergency measures were actually policies that were meant to be kept as sort of the status quo. And so there are major structural issues which have to be addressed. And I want to include another article. Make sure and read this. It's from his CASE Network e-briefs, December 2013. When will the global economy return to rapid growth? In preview, it may not occur. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Dabrowski. We're on a path towards hopeful economic and political outcomes, but one must have a realistic appraisal of where you're starting from and the challenges faced in getting to a goal. So if there are concerning issues in our conversation today, it certainly is in that context of seeking improvement. One issue that seems to be always in front of us, propping up aggregate demand. This seems to be the focus of central planners today and the justification of very loose fiscal and monetary policy. Dr. Dabrowski, can they succeed, and at what cost? I'm thinking particularly of the United States, but this notion of propping up aggregate demand.
Interestingly, you use the notion of central planners. It's another economic system where really policymakers are hyperactive and actually they try to replace market forces. And truly, I think that there's something like this. I would not say that I am totally against demand management. I think this is one of the accomplishments of 20th century economic policy, economic science, understanding that government, central banks can make some kind of fine-tuning. But the question is how far it should go and what are the long-term consequences of such policy. My understanding is that all of those who now call for continuous monetary and fiscal stimulus, they assume that the world economy and economy of individual countries is still below something what we can tell potential growth. And I have big doubts whether really this is the case. Empirically, I would say that was this the case, probably economy would already grow at quite fast rate after 7 years of very loose monetary and fiscal policy, but it didn't happen. So this means that probably that growth potential is much lower than is assumed as the base of this kind of monetary and fiscal activism.
So there are things that have certainly changed in the last several years, perhaps the attempt to return to the growth rates that we had between 2003 and 2007 are no longer possible because of those changing variables. Demographics continue to shift. Investment rates may or may not be sustainable at the rates that we've seen in recent years. We've already reaped the benefits, as they call it, the peace dividend. Things that certainly gave us 20 to 30 years of economic growth, perhaps it is difficult to predicate the next 20 to 30 years of growth on the same things that gave us previous areas of growth.
Yes, you're absolutely right. This is also actually my point. Recently, I wrote a few pieces on this, also including my commentary in Project Syndicate, where I try to put a question whether we can think about the same growth potential as we used to have in 1990s and early 2000, when the global growth was quite rapid by historical standards and both in advanced and economies and emerging markets. But there were various factors in play which we cannot expect that they will be now or in next couple of years. You mentioned demography. And here is obvious that Europe and part of Asia is already on the path of demographic decline, and several other regions will also face soon the problem of declining cohorts of population in productive age. And this will limit growth potential, not only in advanced economy, but also in economies such as China, which face in the next couple of years dramatic reverse of the previous demographic trends, among others as a result of the one-child policy. And this means that one of the neoclassical factors of growth, labor, will be in shortage in many regions of the world. True, still, other regions will grow rapidly in terms of population, in terms of labor force. I mean Africa, Middle East, Southern Asia, including India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, etc. Part of Latin America will continue to grow population quite a rapid pace. But then there is problem of allocation of labor force. Those economies which I mentioned, they will have limits to absorb this labor force for various reasons, shortage of capital or of flows of the economic system. And another solution, which economically would sound rational, large-scale migration from labor surplus region to labor deficit region, it's under question for political reasons. We know how big political tension the problem of migration rises in Europe, rises in countries like Japan, and probably to a lesser extent in the United States, but still this is a quite politically and socially painful topic. So there are limits of moving labor force cross-regionally. Then, of course, there are some room for domestic reforms like increasing retirement age, increasing the rate of employment of female labor force in many countries, many regions, including also some European countries. But still, it cannot compensate for this drastically reverse trends. And then when we look for investment, here we see actually that there is historically very stable global investment rate or even slightly declining over time. And it's unlikely that we can expect that this rate will start to grow again, especially that countries which now contribute the most to this investment rate, China, India, especially China, will not be able to sustain share of investment in GDP around 50% for a long time. It's impossible. Experience of other economies, like for example Japan, demonstrates that with deficit of labor and also with increasing GDP per capita, rate of investment is going down. So in best case, we'll have the same pool of investment which we have now. And then is what is called by neoclassical growth theory, total factor productivity, which is a synthetic measure of various quality factors of growth. And you also mentioned some things like peace dividend, which obviously was in play in 1990s after the end of Cold War. But still, we can gain something more. On the contrary, with terrorism and various unsolved regional conflicts, they keep pressure on military spending in many economies, both advanced and developing. So I don't think that we can expect any additional gains. In terms of technical progress, ICT revolution is largely over in terms of quality changes in the methods of production. Still, we have some new applications, technical application, but they relate mostly to quality of life, to increase with new generation of smartphones. We can live easier or have more entertainment possibilities, but these are not kind of changes which can bring any new revolutionary change to the methods of production. And personally, I don't see any such fundamental revolutionary change in the horizon of the next few years. And then we have various kind of policy reforms which were the economy benefited in 1990s and early 2000s, both country-specific reforms, I mean great reforms in China, in India, in Central Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, in Latin America. They are largely over. Further reforms are needed, including also advanced economy, including Europe, United States, but they will not bring so rapid gains, efficiency gains as those which I mentioned. And also things which greatly contributed to this rapid growth of 1990s and early 2000s, like global trade liberalization or liberalization capital movement. Also, it's already consumed effects. And of course, there is still a large room of additional benefits from trade liberalization. But we see that global trade negotiation actually largely failed, apart from this very limited Bali agreement last fall. But I don't think that this is agreement compared, for example, with the Uruguay Rand and Marrakesh agreement 20 years ago. So there is no low-hanging fruits which can contribute to acceleration of economic growth.
So this brings us to a very interesting discussion. Several years ago, we had a conversation with Harold James about the end of globalization and how there has been multiple periods of globalization which have come to an end. He had a very disconcerting conclusion, which was that when periods of globalization slow or end, political conflict, protectionism, even war are consequences of sort of the end of globalization. Perhaps you could speak to the challenges that we face if, in fact, this is another one of those periods of globalization coming to an end.
Well, it depends how we see the process of globalization. In terms, I would say, of new impulses, you are right that we probably must realize that rapid globalization, which we experienced over the last 30 years, came to the end. But I still hope that this globalization gains will be sustained. Of course, we see various temptation observe to protectionism, but I hope that they will be successfully resisted. We now approach the 100th anniversary of the First World War, or Great War, how it's called by various nations. And of course, this is a very spectacular historical case of the end of globalization, not only in the sense of the lack of further progress, but reversal of the previous case. It was a great catastrophe, not only for Europe, but for the entire world economy. If we look for what's happened then in 1920s, 1930s, and Second World War and after-war period, actually it reversed globalization for more than 50 years. But fortunately, we can avoid this kind of catastrophe. But it's hard to see any new gains coming from further globalization, because financial markets are more or less liberalized. Of course, we have countries like China or India, we still are not fully integrated financially into the world economy. But even if they do some progress, it cannot provide us with so rapid changes as we experienced last 30 years. And in trade, as I thought before, it's still some room for further globalization gains, liberalization gains. But it's not easy to accomplish. There's a lot of political constraints. And now it's very popular regional on cross-regional trade deals. But from point of view of the global free trade, they are not always beneficial. It's a big question, theoretical and practical question. We know that regional trade deals involve both trade creation, but also trade divergence. So it always must be balanced. So it's not obvious that these great trade deals, which are now negotiated on the table, like Trans-Pacific or Transatlantic deal, that they will bring benefits for the entire world economy. This is unclear, at least for me. They should bring benefits for those parties which negotiate. But for the entire world economy, especially for developing countries, it may have some adverse effect. But again, I agree, we don't now have a political atmosphere which could bring us a new rapid trade liberalization.
In the United States, we have seen the Treasury and the Fed operate as lender of last resort through the crisis years. Now, looking at sort of fiscal and monetary policy in the United States, we see the U.S. government as spender of last resort. And you have much experience with the inflationary consequences of expansive monetary and fiscal policy. Is there concern, in your view, about how we're approaching it in the U.S. in terms of, again, sort of stimulating demand via aggressive monetary and fiscal policy? And should we be concerned with an inflationary consequence, even on a lagging basis?
Sure, I'm very concerned. And not necessarily it must produce high inflation in the United States immediately. Fortunately, the few decades of low inflation build some lower inflationary expectation. But this policy is devastating for various other actors, especially this is devastating for emerging market economies, because we know that part of this additional liquidity is going to emerging markets for very obvious reasons. Financial investors are looking for higher rate of return. It's very difficult to find such high rate of return in the United States or other advanced economies with interest rate close to zero and slow growth. So they are going to so-called emerging markets. But of course, this has effects in terms of inflation pressure, in terms of very big fluctuation in capital flows to emerging markets, and it increases various kind of macroeconomic risk. And I cannot exclude that. Everybody asks now, we had U.S. subprime mortgage crisis, we had global financial crisis 2008-09, then we had European debt and financial crisis, which actually is still far from being over, and what is the next stage? It's of course very difficult to guess, but my bet would be the new wave of emerging market crisis, which it's hard to say whether will be copy of the crisis which we experienced in 1980s, meaning sovereign debt crisis in Latin America and several other emerging markets and high inflation, hyperinflation episodes, or will be rather episodes like 1990s Mexico, Asia, Russia, Brazil. It's hard to say, but it's clear. Last 12 months demonstrated that there are several emerging markets which are at high risk. India, Indonesia, Argentina, Venezuela, Ukraine, Turkey. I would not exclude Russia. I would not exclude countries like Hungary, for example, having big troubles. So I don't want to predict any large scale global emerging market crisis, but individual countries can have big problems. And one of the sources of these problems is US monetary policy. In previous years, when it was excessively loose and supply entire global economy lose excess liquidity. And now, finally, it looks that Fed will have to withdraw gradually from this excessive money supply. This will create another type of shock for emerging markets. For example, exchange rate, especially for those countries who have a floating exchange rate, they are very much dependent on US monetary policy. So this is one of the dimensions which this policy already had very negative effect, and probably it still further consequences can be seen. Of course, this also have this ultra loose monetary policy. It also has negative consequences for financial market functioning, for allocation of resources, for financial risks. It helps those enterprises of real sector, which otherwise would have to leave market bankrupt, but availability of cheap financial resources helps them to survive. So there are various consequences. And I am not sure whether we are aware of all these consequences yet. But most importantly, I don't think any potential of this policy to really revive growth, because I think the problem with growth in United States, in Europe, in other advanced economy, also in part of emerging markets, it's supply side problem. We really need to address those barriers which we discussed before, like what to do with shrinking demography, what to do with declining total factor productivity or not increasing so rapidly as it increased in 1990s, early 2000s. So still also, you mentioned beginning of our conversation, 2003-2007. Those years are untypical also for other reasons, not only because the impact on this supply side factors, which we discussed before, of better demography, of investment boom in emerging markets and in various kind of systemic and technical innovation. But also the growth between 2003-2007 was very much fueled exactly by Fed monetary policy. And Fed was followed by other major central banks, by Bank of Japan and European Central Bank, even if European Central Bank doesn't want to admit that it followed Fed, but it really had to follow. So this, of course, built all these bubbles which burst, and then we had process of huge deleveraging. This process is not finished. But this is rather short-term factor, I would say. But still, financial sector is far from being reconstructed.
And it seems to me, of course, I'm not a central banker and have a very limited understanding of this, but 5 to 7 years after the crisis, U.S. monetary policy is still focused on short-term and crisis-related issues. We've allowed a very valuable period of time to go by in which we could have, perhaps, looked at structural issues, the kinds of supply-side problems that we've discussed today, and implemented major structural change. Now, of course, structural change comes at a high political cost, and no one is really interested in doing that unless it's absolutely necessary. But isn't that the point? It has been absolutely necessary, and now through two crises in less than 10 years, the stock market crises in 2001 in the United States, which led to Alan Greenspan's ultra-loose monetary policies, lowering of rates and provision of liquidity to the financial markets, the subsequent boom in real estate and the subprime crisis that followed, and we've basically done the same thing all over again. A repeat of monetary policies focused on short-term crisis-related issues. What will it take for the U.S. or any policymaker around the world to focus on structural issues as opposed to crisis management only?
Well, answer is rather pessimistic and sad, I would say. Usually crisis, serious crisis, is the factor which pushes politicians to do something more serious and create some constituents in favor of reform. Actually, when we look for various episodes of great reforms, even some of them which we mentioned today, for example, China market reforms, it was, of course, consequence of the great leap of Mao model, economic model, which brought starvation and almost collapse of nation. India economic reforms of 1990s, total stagnation and realizations of necessity to factor of geostrategic competition with China. Central Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, collapse of the previous system. Now when we look for Europe, some of European countries are doing reforms. It's a question whether they are doing enough. I would say not, but still are doing something. Countries like Greece, like Spain, like Portugal, Ireland, Italy tries, some countries of Central Eastern Europe. But what was the factor which pushed them to start these reforms? Crisis. Sometimes very dramatic, like in case of Greece. So basically, this is a factor. Of course, we can find some historical exams that political system was able to preempt problems. One of my favorite exams is Germany, early this century. Of course, there was realization that cost of German unification was too high, that some of the elements of this famous soziale Marktwirtschaft models, social market economy, stopped to work, that there is a demographic challenge, that there is too much labor market rigidities, and it pushed Germany to make reforms, maybe not so dramatic and spectacular reforms, for example, done in Central Eastern Europe or Latin America, for example, but large enough to help Germany survive in good shape the recent crisis and be now basically the strong side of the European system. But there are many other countries which hesitate to do reforms. France is one of the big concerns, not only of French economies, but also in Europe, and I think that it should be a very, very big concern for the entire world. This is an economy which needs really very deep structural fiscal reforms. And subsequent governments, either right or left, they mimic some reforms. They are doing some partial reforms. They step forward, step back, or half step back. And situation is, if you look for public debt, is approaching 90% of GDP. If you look at the level of public expenditure, is well over 50% of GDP. Capital is going out of France to other destinations because the business climate is deteriorating, etc., etc. But still, country is not, political class is not ready to face problems. So I think that United States are not unique in this respect. In case of United States, I would say the, from my perspective, one of the most dramatic challenges, this is the political ability to solve fiscal imbalances, because it's a very, very big question for me. When and how quickly it happened. It's very clear for me that U.S. is on unsustainable path of fiscal dynamics. The debt is growing quite rapidly. And all measures which were adopted so far were not effective to stop this trend. And also I can agree with all the critics of sequestration, that it's not the automatic sequestration, it's not the best way of fiscal adjustment. It should be done in more structural way, attacking those fields where is highest expected expenditure dynamic, like social security and all the kind of things. And there is question whether the political system is able quickly to find a solution.
In your research on fiscal deficits, as you notice, U.S. debt is growing. We have our fiscal imbalances. And I know you've written on the financing of fiscal deficits in the past, and you've pointed out that the eventual inflationary effect depends on the size of the deficit being financed. It depends on the money multiplier. It depends on the demand for money. And perhaps you can comment, we remain puzzled by the very low levels of velocity here in the United States. And we do wonder if looking at the low levels of velocity and those various inputs that would lead to inflation on the basis of financing our fiscal deficits, we wonder if we might see more inflation ahead, again, on a lagging basis.
Well, the question about low deficit is really interesting puzzle, and I cannot claim that I have the answer. I think that this is combination of two factors. One is still balance sheets of banks and other financial institutions has not been repaired sufficiently, and also the balance sheets of households and enterprises to come back to, say, more intensive lending borrowing activity. This is perhaps one factor which caused that both money multiplier is lower than used to be 10 years ago, and as a consequence, money velocity is low. But other things is that perhaps this is also an unintended consequence of this ultra-loose monetary policy, which actually not only supplies economies very cheap credit, but also actually it substitutes for normal market channel of distribution of credit. Actually, as far as I understand, in many countries, not only in the United States, central bank low interest rate lead to this partial disappearing of interbank market. And this has negative consequences for allocation of resources, of course. But if some point this market is rebuilt, and some point also balance sheets are rebuilt, we can observe very fast increase of money velocity. And the question is whether Fed and other central banks are well prepared to meet this challenge, because if they are not, then we'll have really inflationary problems. This is a big question. Of course, it's very difficult to argue. We have some interesting historical case, Japan, which is actually already more than 20 years in policy of zero interest rates and no inflationary consequences, even some deflationary consequences, and rapidly growing public debt, which still with very low market yields, etc. But the question is, intuitively, there are limits of such dynamics. At some point, expectations have to change. And the question is when, and whether this change will be slow or whether it will be rapid and dramatic. If it's to be rapid, dramatic, then this will create huge challenge for central banks, because no longer will be discussion about tapering of QE and perspective, whether it will come to normal policy in 2 years' time or 3 years. This will require very, very rapid changes, returning to normal monetary policy or even with high interest rates. Actually, there was some kind of experience, not fully comparable, because this was period of high inflation, relatively high inflation, and then attempts to stop this inflation at end of 1970s, early 1980s. Of course, situation was different at that time. We are not now in the stage that we have inflation to GDP inflation in advanced economies. But who knows? In 1970s, it was oil price shock which served as accelerator to all this monetary process. So one cannot rule out there may be some shock which change market behavior, and volatility started to rise rapidly, and then central bank will have to dramatically change their policies.
Well, I will encourage all of our listeners to read the brief article that you wrote for Project Syndicate, as well as your Case Network e-brief from December of 2013. If you don't mind, we'll make that available on our website so it's easy to find and people can view that. Very keen insights. Again, going back to where we began a conversation today, we are hopefully on a path towards economic and political growth and a positive outcome ultimately. It's our view that you need a realistic appraisal of where you're starting from and the challenges that you face in order to accomplish any future goals. So we appreciate you adding your insights from across the pond, from across the Atlantic, both into our issues in the United States, but as well as the global context, emerging market concerns, currency crises concerns, and the policy changes which need to be considered very quickly in order to make sure that we are on the appropriate path towards growth. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to keeping in touch in future conversations.
Thank you very much. It was a big pleasure to speak with you.
Well, David, depth of experience is something you cannot replace. And, you know, when you and I are talking about Europe, we're talking about we're visitors. We haven't been through the changes. Dr. Dabrowski was there and helping to manage probably one of the most prolific changes, at least on the Eastern Bloc side of things during that time. But I want to bring something up that William White also brought up as a concern a couple of weeks ago. Both of these central bankers right now are not that concerned about inflation, but they look at velocity, which is how many times the dollar turns over in a year, and they're concerned that the central bankers won't know what hit them if velocity actually does increase.
And will they change their policy quickly? Because that's what it's going to take. And going back to sort of the MacGyver picture, if you will, you have to be able to change course very quickly when the variables change. You can't just hold on to previous policy commitments assuming that it will work itself out.
And let's talk about that, because the changing course, that could be devastating. What we're talking about is raising interest rates and tightening monetary policy.
Right. And this is a problem. We really have to address the fact that we still have sort of a welfare state here in the United States, but as Dr. Dabrowski pointed out, also in places like France, where there is no willingness to reform. You know, I think particularly compelling in our conversation today was the notion that it is serious crisis that creates constituents who are willing to accept the painful changes necessary for structural reform. And ironic that we've been through two serious crises in the United States, and yet perhaps they're not serious at all. Perhaps they are just foreshocks of what is to come, because we have yet to see the development of a constituency that is willing to take the pain of reform and see sort of entrenched interests undone. So what are the policies that we will have which represent structural reform in the next 5, 10, 15 years? We don't know. But what will be the precipitating events that opens our minds to such change? I think this is what we glean was the major reforms in China after tens of millions of people died. It was the major reforms in India after socialism was completely failed. It was only after a complete catastrophe in Central Europe. It was only after the collapse in Russia. I mean, all of these things where you say, well, you know, a little pain and perhaps people will say, I don't like this. No, in fact, people don't really change and policymakers don't really make the significant, fundamental, structural changes until circumstances are very serious and the current paradigm breaks.
Well, you know, Dave, that's something that I think we probably ought to bring the moral to the story. We talk to these guys, but we also know our audience. Most of these people are not central bankers and they're not policymakers for the most part. And so what we're basically saying is prepare for this paradigm break. We're not necessarily saying it's the end of the world, but if you're not prepared ahead of time, I have to bring back the thought that back in 2007, 2008, Dr. Dabrowski was talking about a crisis that he was predicting, and it certainly came to pass.
Yeah, it's not without surprise when you look at the fundamental issues which need to be addressed, and they're not changing at all, haven't for the last 10 years, 15 years in the United States, and we still see that same sort of intransigence in Europe. It's no surprise that the crisis continues on and morphs, changes a bit from here to there. What is the next iteration of crisis? As he said, perhaps it is in the emerging markets, and perhaps it is a replay in Europe, and perhaps it's here in the United States. So in summary, do take the time to read the two articles attached from Project Syndicate and from the Case Network e-briefs. Those, I think, will be a good insight into what he sees as the major concerns that we still have to address before we can consider our return to growth. If these structural issues are not addressed, you had better prepare your portfolios accordingly.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Dr. Merrick Dabrowski. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.